Unused prescription opioid pain medicines can spell trouble. They can spell risk if taken by someone they weren't prescribed for. Harm if accidentally taken by a child or pet. Or overdose if they're not used as directed. Safely dispose of opioids before they can hurt your family. Find a drug take-back option such as medicine drop boxes. You may find these in your community, at local pharmacies or police stations. Visit www.fda.gov/drug disposal.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This is now a multi-front concerted effort to try to interfere in the midterm elections that's taking place in a number of different ways from Georgia to Minnesota and beyond.
Voting rights advocates are expressing alarm after the Republican-led House passes a bill that could disenfranchise millions of voters, while shocking new details reveal a prominent election denier played a key role in the FBI's recent raid on the Fulton County Election Office in Georgia. We'll speak to Ari Berman of Mother Jones. Then Bishop William Barber leads a 50-mile march from Wilson to Raleigh, North Carolina, to push for health care, immigrant rights, and voting access.
It's time for those who love education and health care, who love a society where you don't have to be worried about people in our name claiming to be officers of the law shooting our people down in the street. It's time for love to turn it up, and to turn it on.
Then a humanitarian crisis is growing in Cuba as the U.S. blocks all oil shipments to the island as part of an attempt to topple the Cuban government. We'll speak to Cuba's ambassador to the United Nations. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Trump administration's formally rescinded the EPA's so-called endangerment finding, the 2009 determination that carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions pose a threat to public health. The finding had allowed the EPA to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act for nearly two decades. The repeal of the endangerment finding eliminates greenhouse gas emission standards for U.S. cars and trucks and clears the way for heavy industry to roll back limits on air pollution. EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin joined President Trump at the White House Thursday to announce the deregulation.
The endangerment finding and the regulations that were based on it didn't just regulate emissions. It regulated and targeted the American dream. And now the endangerment finding is hereby eliminated, as well as all greenhouse gas emission standards that followed.
Environmental and public health groups called the repeal a massive blow to efforts to mitigate the climate crisis worldwide and have promised legal challenges. David Arkush, director of Public Citizens Climate Program, said in response, quote, "If left to stand, this action will hamstring the government's ability to combat the most terrible environmental threat in human history, harming Americans and the world for decades to come," he said. On Capitol Hill, senators failed to advance a bill Thursday that would have funded the Department of Homeland Security through September, setting up a partial government shutdown at midnight tonight. Democrats are seeking limits on how agents with ICE and other federal immigration agencies operate, including a ban on facial coverings, requiring agents to show ID and to obtain judicial warrants to enter private property, stricter use of force policies, and more. A shutdown isn't likely to impact the Trump administration's mass deportation policies anytime soon, since Congress granted ICE $75 billion as part of Republicans' so-called One Big Beautiful Bill. President Trump's so-called border czar, Tom Homan, said Thursday federal agents will be ending Operation Metro Surge in Minnesota.
I have proposed, and President Trump has concurred, that this surge operation conclude. A significant drawdown has already been underway this week and will continue through the next week.
The weeks-long crackdown saw about 3,000 officers from ICE, Border Patrol, and other federal agencies conduct immigration sweeps across the Twin Cities, often while masked and riding in unmarked vehicles. More than 4,000 people were detained as agents routinely deployed tear gas and pepper spray against protesters and bystanders, including children. Federal agents shot 3 people in Minnesota, 2 of them fatally, Renee Good and Alex Preti. On Thursday, protesters continued to gather outside the Whipple Federal Building in Minneapolis, skeptical of the Trump administration's claims. This is anti-ICE protester Richie Mead.
Actions speak louder than words. So until we see them actually leave, we don't believe it. We're going to be out here until they prove it, until they stop running this Gestapo SUV, running through our streets, snatching up our neighbors, murdering our neighbors. Until that ends, we don't believe it.
In more news from Minneapolis, a Marine Corps veteran who served in Iraq and Afghanistan says federal agents who unlawfully sampled his DNA, scanned his face, and cloned his phone after detaining him as he stood on the sidewalk observing their movements. Stephen Sari had gone to the scene of Alex Preti's killing less than an hour after Border Patrol agents fired the fatal shots with a lawfully owned pistol on his hip. He says he was mobbed by federal agents and brought to the Whipple Federal Building, where he was denied access to a lawyer and detained for 6 hours before his release without charge. Sari told The Intercept that federal agents took scans and samples of his biometric data and made a copy of his phone, all without obtaining a warrant. The Internal Revenue Service improperly shared private taxpayer data on thousands of people with the Homeland Security Department as part of Trump's crackdown on immigration, likely in violation of federal law. That's according to the Washington Post, which reports DHS issued an agreement last year with the Treasury Department to allow federal immigration enforcement officers request access to the names and addresses of people suspected of being in the U.S. without documentation. The IRS reported sent data on 47,000 people out of a request for 1.2 million records, including thousands whose private information was erroneously shared. Undocumented immigrants have for decades paid taxes in the United States with the promise their personal information would be protected. A federal judge has ordered the Trump administration facilitate the return to the United States from Venezuela of nearly 140 Venezuelan men who were sent to El Salvador's Secat mega prison last March and accused without evidence of being gang members. On Thursday, Judge James Boasberg directed Trump officials to bring the men back to fight their cases in a U.S. court after being denied due process when they were expelled under the wartime Alien Enemy Act, secretly flown to El Salvador despite an emergency court order blocking their removal. Some of the men had pending asylum cases in the U.S. Boasberg's ruling is being described as one of the toughest steps taken against Trump's mass deportation campaign. Palestinian activist Lekha Cordia has issued her first statement since she was released from the hospital earlier this week and sent back to ICE custody. Cordia's family and lawyers spent several days searching for her, with ICE refusing to share information about her whereabouts. She's been jailed at ICE's Prairie Land Detention Facility in North Texas for almost a year. In the statement, Cordia writes, quote, "I woke up in the Prairie Land Detention Facility's medical unit terrified and confused after having experienced the first seizure of my life. Not until enduring nearly a year of cruel confinement in inhumane conditions had I ever suffered one before. All I felt was fear. For 3 days in the emergency room, my hands and legs were weighed down by heavy chains. They even refused to remove the chains when I went to the bathroom or took a shower. The only reason ICE targeted me in the first place is because I protested against the Israeli government's genocide in Gaza. Even now, U.S.-made bombs continue to destroy Palestinian homes and kill Palestinian families, Lakhar Kordia wrote. The mayor of New York, Mamdani, has also called for her release. To see our coverage of her case, go to democracynow.org. The United Kingdom's High Court has overturned the government's ban on the pro-Palestinian campaign group Palestine Action, although the organization will remain proscribed as the UK government appeals the ruling. Last July, the British government banned Palestine Action under the UK's strict anti-terrorism laws, adding it to a list that includes ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Palestine Action's co-founder, Huda Amouri, who challenged the ban in court, said in a statement, quote, "This is a monumental victory, both for our fundamental freedoms here in Britain and in the struggle for freedom for the Palestinian people, striking down a decision that will forever be remembered as one of the most extreme attacks on free speech in recent British history," unquote. Two Mexican ships carrying urgent humanitarian aid arrived in Cuba's capital, Havana, Thursday, as the United Nations warns the island is facing humanitarian collapse due to the Trump administration's oil blockade. Infant mortality is also on the rise in Cuba as the United States tightens its decades-old economic embargo on the island as part of Trump's efforts to overthrow the Cuban government. We'll have more on Cuba later in the broadcast with Cuba's ambassador to the United Nations, Ernesto Soberón Guzmán. U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright arrived in Venezuela Wednesday as the Trump administration seeks control over Venezuela's oil industry. Wright's the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit Venezuela since Trump's military attack and abduction of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife in early January. Wright met with interim Venezuelan President Delcy Rodriguez.
The Venezuelan people welcome those who come to our country with open arms. We are also willing to welcome investors from around the world, including the United States, to work alongside us, bringing the oil industry up to the highest standards.
On Thursday, Wright toured facilities in Venezuela's Orinoco Belt, which holds one of the largest reserves of crude oil, with Chevron officials. Delcy Rodriguez's interim government has also sent Venezuela's first oil shipment to Israel in nearly two decades. The late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, a staunch supporter of Palestine, cut relations with Israel in 2009. California Congressmember Ro Khanna is calling on the Justice Department to unredact the name of a Republican politician who sent Jeffrey Epstein a friendly email boasting about receiving more votes than Jeb Bush in the 2016 Iowa caucuses. The email ends with the valediction, "Love ya," but the signature is redacted. On Thursday, Khanna called the redaction a direct violation of the Epstein Files Transparency Act, which Khanna co-sponsored. In more fallout from the Epstein files, Katherine Rumler abruptly resigned as the top lawyer at Goldman Sachs on Thursday after newly released files showed she offered Epstein advice on how to respond to sex crimes charges and addressed him as sweetie and Uncle Jeffrey. In Norway, police have charged former Prime Minister Torbjørn Jagland with gross corruption over his close ties to Epstein after the Council of Europe lifted the diplomatic immunity that came with his former post. Investigators are probing whether Jagland received gifts, travel, and loans from Epstein. Meanwhile, there's a growing debate in Norway under whether Crown Princess Mette Marit should be eligible to become queen after newly released files revealed her extensive warm ties to the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. In Dubai, There's growing pressure on the multinational logistics company DP World to fire its CEO, Sultan Ahmed Ben Sulayem, one of the UAE's most powerful figures. Emails show he traded messages about businesses and pleasure with Epstein for decades. Lawmakers who were granted access to unredacted Epstein files this week cited one memo in which Epstein stated to Sulayem, quote, "I loved the torture video," unquote. A federal judge has blocked Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's effort to reduce the retirement rank and pay of Arizona Democratic Senator Mark Kelly, a former astronaut and retired U.S. Navy captain who publicly called on U.S. service members to disobey unlawful orders. In Thursday's ruling, U.S. District Judge Richard Leon, a George W. Bush nominee, blasted the Trump administration's efforts to chill constitutionally protected speech, writing, quote, "This court has all it needs to conclude that defendants have trampled on Senator Kelly's First Amendment freedoms and threatened the constitutional liberties of millions of military retirees. To say the least, our retired veterans deserve more respect from their government, and our Constitution demands they receive it," the judge said. And here in New York, cheers erupted as elected officials joined LGBTQ plus activists who raised a rainbow flag over the Stonewall National Monument in Manhattan on Thursday. Their defiant protest came days after the Trump administration removed a rainbow flag that had flown for years above the site of the 1969 Stonewall Rebellion, a landmark event in U.S. civil rights history. This is New York City resident Nicole Mallett.
We will not be erased. We will not be go back in the closet. No taking down of any flag will not remove us from our nation and the legacy that we have built as human beings, as citizens.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Voting rights advocates are expressing alarm after the Republican-led House passed a bill Wednesday that could disenfranchise millions of voters. By a vote of 218 to 213, Republicans approved the so-called Save America Act, which would require voters to show passports or birth certificates to register to vote or update their voter registration information. The bill also effectively eliminates online and mail voter registration. Demetria McCain of the Legal Defense Fund responded to the vote by saying, quote, "The Save America Act is not about protecting our elections. It's about disguising voter suppression techniques aimed at disenfranchising black voters as election security," unquote. The Save America Act now heads to the Senate, where it faces some Republican opposition. Meanwhile, shocking new details have emerged about how a prominent election denier played a key role in the FBI's recent raid on the Fulton County Election Office in Georgia. An unsealed search warrant affidavit reveals the raid came after a referral from Kurt Olson, a lawyer who tried to overturn the 2020 election. One of the debunked claims listed in the affidavit comes from a so-called citizen researcher named Joe Rossi, who claimed that the number of ballot images for Fulton County did not match the full total number of ballots cast. But the state of Georgia did a machine and hand recount of the ballots and confirmed the tally. To talk about all of this and more, we're joined by Ari Berman, the national voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. His most recent article, headlined "The GOP Show Us Your Papers Bill," is the latest effort to help Trump take over elections. He's also the author of Minority Rule, the right-wing attack on the will of the people and the fight to resist it. Ari, welcome back to Democracy Now! Start off with this latest vote in the House, the significance of and what is the SAVE Act?
Good morning, Amy and Juan. Thank you for having me back on the show. So the Save America Act is a new version of the SAVE Act, which passed the House last year and then passed the House again this week. And it would be, if passed, the worst voter suppression bill ever passed by Congress, because it has sweeping new restrictions on voting. And it comes at a time when President Trump says he wants to take over the voting process and nationalize voting. And this bill would nationalize new restrictions on voting in a few different ways. The centerpiece of the bill remains a show your papers requirement, meaning you need a passport or a birth certificate to register to vote. That would be extremely restrictive. Half of all Americans don't have passports, for example. 21 million Americans don't have ready access to their citizenship documents. A much larger number of people could be affected. For example, 69 million married women took their partner's name and have birth certificates that are different than their current last name and could be disenfranchised. So the Show Your Papers bill is really the headline. There's other parts of the bill as well. They have a national voter ID requirement for the first time, which would be extremely restrictive. It would not allow student IDs or tribal IDs. It would disproportionately harm younger people and voters of color. And then the third part of the bill would require states to hand over their voter rolls to the Department of Homeland Security, something that the DOJ has long tried to get. That means your sensitive private information would be in the hands of Kristi Noem. And that could lead to faulty voter purges based on inaccurate citizenship data. So the bill really combines a lot of the worst things that Republicans want to do with regards to voting. And it comes at a time when Trump appears dead set to try to interfere in the midterm elections.
But Ari, is any of this constitutional, given the fact that the Constitution gives to the states the power to run elections?
Well, that's a very good question, Juan, and it would certainly be challenged in court. Trump tried to do many of these same kind of things through executive order. For example, he tried to pass an executive order last year that would require proof of citizenship to register to vote in federal elections, and that was blocked by courts as executive overreach. And we have a very decentralized system that makes it hard for both the president and Congress to encroach on it. But what we're seeing, Juan, is that the president and his allies are trying to ignore the Constitution in so many different ways. They are trying to usurp power that belongs to the states when it comes time to voting, when it relates to voting, so that they can try to take more control in order to interfere in some way or another with the midterm elections.
And what are the prospects of this passing the Senate?
Well, the good news is it's unlikely to pass the Senate because they aren't able to get 60 votes to overcome a filibuster. It's not even clear they would get 50 votes on a simple majority because Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski has already spoken out about this. I should add that a lot of the bill disproportionately impacts Republican constituencies. For example, the fact that married women could be disenfranchised who have taken their partner's name. Republican women are more likely to take their partner's name than Democratic women. Their bill also requires you to show citizenship documentation in person at an elections office. That would effectively end online registration, mail registration, voter registration drives, and it would force people in rural areas to drive very long distances to be able to register to vote in person at an elections office. Rural areas tend to lead more red than blue. And so in a lot of ways, this bill would disenfranchise Republican constituencies more than Democratic constituencies. And I think that is also giving some members of the Republican Senate pause.
Can you talk about the difference between requiring ID and requiring immigration status information?
There's a big difference, and that's a really good point, Amy, because this is being sold as a voter ID bill. And of course, every state requires some sort of proof of identity to be to register to vote. But the most common way that people would show their identity is a driver's license. Well, the requirement to show your papers is much broader than that because it requires a passport or a birth certificate to be able to register to vote. Most people do not carry a passport or birth certificate around with them, like a driver's license. So that means that a lot more people could be affected. These documents are expensive. A passport could cost $100 or more. It takes a long time to get. Not everyone knows where their birth certificate is. Not everyone has access to their birth certificate. So the talking points we hear is you need an ID to buy liquor. You need an ID to get on a plane, et cetera, et cetera. First off, those are not constitutionally protected rights. But we're not talking about needing an ID for those things. We're talking about needing citizenship papers, which you've never needed in any previous election to be able to register to vote. And it's all predicated on the lie that non-citizens are voting in U.S. elections. There's absolutely no evidence that non-citizens are voting in U.S. elections. We've had study after study after study that have shown this. Most recently, there was an audit by Utah of its voter rolls. They looked at the 2.1 million people on their voter rolls. They didn't find a single non-citizen who cast a ballot. So it's definitely a solution in search of a problem.
And Ari, I wanted to ask you about this situation in Fulton County, Georgia, that we mentioned earlier in the program, this FBI raid. There was a criminal referral from Kurt Olson, a temporary White House employee with the title of Director of Election Security and Integrity. Can you tell us a little bit more about Olson?
Yeah, Kurt Olson is not a household name, but he was a leader of the Stop the Steal movement in 2020. He became active in Trump's orbit. He tried to persuade the Justice Department to file a lawsuit before the Supreme Court overturning the election. Texas eventually filed that. That was unsuccessful. He talked to Trump numerous times on January 6th during the insurrection. He then became part of Kerry Lake, Republican gubernatorial candidate Kerry Lake's campaign in 2022 in Arizona. He was sanctioned by a federal court for making false claims about the election. He has been traveling around the country making false claims about the election with the likes of Mike Flynn, Mike Lindell, Steve Bannon. So he is part of a whole crew of election deniers that have made false claims about the election, but have now been promoted to key roles in the White House. And that's what was so shocking about the Fulton County affidavit, was it recycled so many lies about the 2020 election that have been thoroughly debunked in court in Georgia by investigators all across the country. And the fact that this stuff is still being used 5 years later by people at the White House to persuade the FBI and a federal and a state judge to take 700 boxes of ballots is really astonishing. I mean, we are seeing lies pushed by election deniers and the Trump administration weaponized by law enforcement in the most harmful of ways. And I believe it's all being used as a predicate to try to interfere in the midterm election.
And what is the latest on what we understand why Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence, was there perhaps overseeing this operation? At least what we know is she provided the cell phone for the FBI agents who went in and took the 700 boxes to speak directly with the president of the United States.
Well, that was another really big question after reading the affidavit, was why was Tulsi Gabbard there? Because the Director of National Intelligence is prohibited by law from participating in domestic law enforcement operations. Her only portfolio with regards to elections would be stopping foreign interference in the elections. And the affidavit didn't make any allegations of foreign interference in the 2020 election in Fulton County, let alone provide evidence of that. So the affidavit, even the quote-unquote evidence that was provided, completely refuted the idea that Tulsi Gabbard should have been there. So the fact that she was there, the fact that she put President Trump on the phone with FBI agents, it just raises huge red flags about this entire operation. And the affidavit provided many more questions than answers about how this reached the level of a criminal inquiry and why the administration wants this information and what they're planning to do with these 700 boxes of ballots and voting records that they've now seized.
It's a fascinating article in The Atlantic recently headlined, MAGA thinks Maduro will prove Trump won in 2020. The article quotes MyPillow founder Mike Lindell saying, quote, "I'm hoping now that Maduro will actually come clean and tell us everything about the machines and how they steal the elections," unquote. Some have speculated Trump could pardon Maduro in exchange for him stating Venezuela interfered in the 2020 election, even though no evidence of that exists. Your final comments, Ari.
That's really a chilling possibility, because we already know that Tulsi Gabbard and her team were in Puerto Rico looking for Venezuelan evidence of interference
in that election. They didn't find any evidence of Venezuelan interference, but it wouldn't be shocking for the Trump administration to lean on Maduro and say, come clean, admit that you interfered in the 2020 election, and I'll give you a pardon. Now, that would be a total fabrication, but we've seen how the president in so many different ways has weaponized law enforcement to meet his own political ends. And the fact is, they have concocted so many elaborate schemes about how the election was rigged. And their latest scheme seems to center around Venezuela. And they now have a lot of leverage with Venezuela because they're essentially running the country. And the former leader of Venezuela is within their custody. And so this would be a total fabrication. It would be a complete lie, but it would just be another chilling signal about how far the administration intends to go, not just to relitigate their own lies about the 2020 election, but to have a pretext to try to interfere in the next election as well.
Ari Berman, we want to thank you so much for being with us, national voting rights correspondent for Mother Jones Magazine. We'll link to your new article, The GOP Show Us Your Papers Bill, is the latest effort to help Trump take over elections. Coming up, Bishop William Barber is leading a 50-mile march from Wilson to Raleigh, North Carolina, to push for health care, immigrant rights, and voting access. Stay with us.
Una canción de amor esta noche es lo que yo te quiero entregar para que solo tú la retoces. Para romperla luego de amar. Una canción de amor esta noche, inesperada para mi voz. Una canción de amor y de goce, una canción de amor de los dos, una canción chorubiada, una canción chorobodiada.
Una canción, a song by the Cuban singer Silvio Rodriguez, performing at New York Central Park years ago. In our next segment, we'll be speaking to the Cuban ambassador to the United Nations. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to North Carolina, where Bishop William Barber and other faith leaders are on a 50-mile march from Wilson to Raleigh to push for health care for all, immigrant rights, and voting access. The march began Wednesday at the St. Jerome's Church in Wilson, North Carolina. This is the church's pastor, Reverend Della Owens Barber.
My brothers and sisters, we are here today when the North Carolina General Assembly received an order to engage in mid-cycle racist redistricting in an effort to abridge voting rights. Uh-huh. But oh no, we are going to march. Yes. And we decided we're going to march, we're going to walk, we're going to drive, we're going to caravan for 3 days.
Yes.
To love forward together. And to mobilize voters to the poll, going from county to county, precinct to precinct. We will march until the walls of ICE raids come down.
Yes.
We will march until the walls of poverty fall down.
Yes.
We will march until the walls of religious nationalism fall down.
Yes.
We will march until the walls of environmental degradation fall down.
Yes.
The Reverend Della Owens Barber, the wife of Bishop William Barber. Bishop William Barber also spoke in Wilson, North Carolina, Wednesday.
It's time for those who love truth-telling to turn it up and turn it on. It's time for those who love education and health care, who love a society where you don't have to be worried about people in our name claiming to be officers of the law shooting our people down in the street. It's time for love to turn it up, and to turn it on.
Yes, yes.
Am I right about it?
Yes.
We're joined now by Reverend Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove of Repairers of the Breach. He's joining us from the march in Knightdale, North Carolina. Welcome to Democracy Now, Reverend Wilson Hartgrove. Explain why you're there.
Thank you, Amy. It's good to be with you. I'm here in Knightdale. This is day 3 of this march from Wilson to Raleigh. We're here to love forward together, we're saying. And we've got ministers of various denominations here. Our brother Buddhist monk here with us. Many people of many faiths and of no particular faith, but who know that love is the power that can overcome fear in this moment. And so we're marching to defy the attempt to steal a House seat here and to say we're going to love forward towards the things that we know and love for this place.
And Reverend, there is an effort in North Carolina to challenge a lawsuit challenging the redistricting effort. Could you explain to people who are not in your state what you most object to about the way that this gerrymandering has occurred?
Well, I was glad to hear Ari Berman explaining one of the ways that the current regime is trying to subvert the upcoming election, but they may not need Maduro's help if they can get help from folks here in North Carolina. So Donald Trump called the North Carolina legislature and said, find me an extra House seat. And the folks in charge of the legislature here said they would be glad to do that. And so they drew a gerrymander that took the places that we've been walking through for the last few days out of District 1 and put them in District 3 because they think, based on their calculations, that they can do that and steal District 1 from the people who elected their representative there. The reality, though, is that you can only do this by borrowing from places that you think are safe. Mm-hmm. And we believe that the most powerful pushback mm-hmm. against this robbery is for voters to show up.
Yes.
So early voting here started yesterday in our primary, and we've been walking and talking to folks about what they love and what they want for their state and letting everybody know that we have the power of love, to show up and to not only keep the power we have, but maybe even expand power, because the danger of a gerrymander, the political scientists say, is that it can become a dummy-mander. And we're hoping that there's going to be one big dummy-mander here in North Carolina.
And Repairers of the Breach and your movement have also called for welcoming immigrants, not ICE. Could you talk about your concerns about the raids occurring around the country under the direction of President Trump?
Well, the abuse of power that begins with voter suppression and election subversion then gets used to support policies that bring violence to our communities. And we know that the one big bill that passed Congress last year, the big, ugly, deadly, and destructive bill that gave so much money to ICE to empower them to do what they're doing now, that same bill took money away from people right here, people who need health care, people who need nutrition assistance. That's what is at stake in the midterm elections. This isn't about left versus right or Democrats versus Republicans. This is about whether we're going to stand up and love the people and the places that we know.
That's right.
And so all of these policies matter. And voting matters, because they wouldn't be trying to steal an election if it didn't matter. So we're out here encouraging everybody in North Carolina to show up and to reclaim our power to love forward together.
And what are your plans on Valentine's Day when you arrive in Raleigh in North Carolina, Reverend Jonathan
Wilson
Hartgrove?
Well, we got a bunch of people out here today. We're going to be walking from here all the way into Raleigh. We'll get to the old Capitol by the end of the march today, and early tomorrow morning, folks are going to gather at Shaw University, and we're going to march right up Fayetteville Street. We're going to fill it up with people who want to love forward together, and we'll have a rally there We're going to have lots of people sharing about why they've made the walk, about why we're committed to reach out to low income and infrequent voters in North Carolina. We've got some special gifts that have been sent from friends around the country, a song from Brother Willie Nelson and other things. We're going to have a big celebration of this agenda of Loving Forward Together as a way of launching and beginning an effort for the months ahead to turn out the largest midterm vote in North Carolina history.
Thank you for being with us, Reverend Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, Assistant Director and Lecturer, the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. All the best to Bishop Barber. Coming up, a humanitarian crisis is growing in Cuba as the U.S. blocks all oil shipments to the island as part of an attempt to topple the Cuban government. We'll speak to Cuba's ambassador to the United Nations. Stay with us.
Una canción de amor no es difícil. Cuando se viene de maldecir, los dos idiomas viven felices y hacen familia para vivir. Una canción de amor que se mueve fuera del odio, el miedo, el quizás. Será de amor por si tú me quieres. Será canción por si tú te vas.
Una canción, a song by the Cuban singer Silvio Rodriguez, performing at New York Central Park years ago. He just finished a Latin American tour and is back in Cuba. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Cuba's facing a growing humanitarian crisis due to a U.S.-imposed oil blockade. Cuba's government announced Monday it's running out of fuel for commercial aviation, prompting Air Canada to cancel flights to and from the island. The Trump administration's threatened new tariffs against any nation that sends fuel to Cuba, which has been under a U.S. economic embargo since 1962, more than half a century ago. In recent years, Venezuela had been a key supplier of oil for Cuba, but that supply was cut off in early January after U.S. forces attacked Venezuela and abducted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife. The Trump administration's Cuba policy is being led by Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who has long called for regime change in Cuba, where his parents were born. Fuel shortages in Cuba have prompted major blackouts, while the cost of food and transportation has skyrocketed. In recent weeks, top UN officials have repeatedly warned about the impact of the U.S. oil blockade.
The Secretary General is extremely concerned about the humanitarian situation in Cuba, which will worsen, if not collapse, if its oil needs go unmet. He notes that for more than three decades, the General Assembly has consistently called for an end to the embargo imposed by the United States on Cuba. The Secretary General urges all parties to pursue dialogue and respect for international law.
In January, Mexico also stopped sending fuel to Cuba, but Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum has openly criticized the U.S. oil blockade against Cuba, describing the policy as, quote, very unfair. Earlier this week, Mexico sent two ships carrying humanitarian aid to Cuba. This is President Sheinbaum speaking earlier this week.
This sanction being imposed on countries that sell oil to Cuba is very unjust, very unfair. It's not right because sanctions that affect the people are not right. You can agree or disagree with Cuba's government, but the people should never be affected.
On Thursday, residents of Havana gathered as Mexican ships unloaded white pallets of humanitarian aid. This is Pavel Martinez.
The country is going through a very complicated situation. With the United States blocking fuel, practically the entire economy stops. I think Mexico is doing a good deed for us, regardless of the commercial contract that exists, as the president of Mexico has said. The friendship that has always existed between Cuba, Mexico, and several other countries in the area, Cuba has also provided help in other ways. I think now it's our turn to receive help because of the situation the United States has put us in.
We're joined right now by Cuba's ambassador to the United Nations, Ernesto Soberón Guzmán. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm glad Democracy Now! Falls in the 25-mile zone around Columbus Circle where you're allowed to travel. Can you explain why you are so limited?
Well, first of all, Amy, thank you very much for having us this opportunity to participate in your show. And by the way, lovely son of Silvio Rodriguez, the son of love. So it's what we need right now. Well, as you said, yes, we have a restriction of movement here at the in New York. The member of our staff, we only have 25 miles around Columbus Circle to move. So, which is a measure just that affect Cuban mission and some other few missions. The rest of the diplomats accredited in New York, they have a free movement, not only in New York, but all over around the U.S. And that's part of the policy of aggression of the U.S. government against Cuba, because there is no other reason that you limited the movement of the diplomat accredited to the U.N.
I want to ask you about the Trump administration's fuel blockade on Cuba that has pushed the island to the brink of humanitarian collapse. That's what the United Nations has warned, as the Cuban people face more frequent power outages, shortages of basic necessities, skyrocketing costs of food transportation. And your government, Cuba's government, announced Monday it's run out of fuel for commercial aviation. So you've got Air Canada saying they won't fly in or out. Why don't you describe right now the conditions on the ground?
Well, first of all, I would like to say that the word collapse, betrayed, give up are not in our dictionary, you know. Even when we face a situation like this, which is a very, very complex situation, the words that are in our dictionary are resistance, resilience, find solution for our problem, you know, because this is not the first time that we face a situation like this. The point is that, first of all, the question is, it is right, not only unfair, but it is legal that a third country tell other countries that they can do or they cannot do something? Do the U.S. government has the right to say something like this? Is that a violation of the international law? Is that a violation of the rules of the foreign trade? Is that a violation of the charter of the U.N.? Yes. It is. So the situation is very complicated because, as you can imagine, it has a huge impact, not only from the humanitarian point of view, because, of course, for the hospital, you need electricity. For the education system, you need electricity. For production, for food production, you need electricity. If you produce foods, you need to transport food from one point to other point, and you need also fuel. If you need for our research, scientific research, you need electricity also. So what they are doing is trying to create as much problem as possible, and it is not a new strategy. It comes since 1960, when the Under Secretary of State at that time, Lester Mallory, said that the only way to defeat the Cuban government is to create economic problems, is to create a situation that a social and humanitarian situation so worse that the Cuban people cannot resist something like this. But the history showed that we have been resisting for the last 67 years, and we are ready to continue to finding solution for our problem. But and the point is, why does the U.S. government need to do something like this against a small country like Cuba? because the pretext to sign the executive order on January 29 was that Cuba posed a threat to the U.S. National security. So how's possible that someone can believe that small country like Cuba suppose or pose a threat to the U.S. national security?
Ambassador, I wanted to ask you, most Americans are not aware that the entire blockade of the last 60 years is universally condemned by practically every nation in the world, except for the United States and Israel at the United Nations. It's been condemned every single year, yet it continues. If you could talk about this flagrant, because our media never says this is an illegal blockade of the United States against Cuba. If you could talk about that.
Of course. Good morning, Mr. Juan. As you said, for the last 33 years, the UN General Assembly has voted a resolution against the embargo of the U.S. to Cuba. You know, with the overwhelming support of the international community that are saying the U.S. government for the last 33 years, you have to leave the embargo. But it is not only the embargo. This is an economic war, you know, because it is the embargo. But it is also to include Cuba in the list of a state of a sponsor of terrorism. You know, former President Biden, 6 days before to leave the White House, he removed Cuba from the list of a sponsor of terrorism based on reports made by U.S. Agencies that said that Cuba is not linking with the supporting of terrorism, you know. But a week later, President Trump include Cuba again in the list without taking in account the report made by the U.S. Agencies. But what does it mean that Cuba is included in the list of sponsors of terrorism? One single example. U.S. government has canceled around or more than 300,000 ESTA visas, electronic visas, for European citizens just because they visited Cuba as a tourist. So that means that countries like Dominican Republic or Mexico, where they receive a lot of Europeans tourists also, they have recovered the number of tourists that they received before COVID. And Cuba didn't. Why? Because measures like this. So the question is, why does the U.S. government wants that Europeans tourists don't visit Cuba? But second question, why the U.S. government don't allow the U.S. citizens to visit Cuba as a tourist? Because when we have this moment of engagement policy during the President Obama, Americans, Cuba became the first overworld destination for the Americans tourists, especially those ones that travel with cruise ship companies based on Florida. And every time that they return to the U.S., they said it was not so worse like you told me before, because they found a country with problems, of course, like everywhere, but they found also a problem with friendly people, with delicious food, with amazing culture, so with a safe country. So it was a place where they enjoy when they visited. So we have the embargo, we have the list of sponsors of terrorism, and also now we have the executive order of January 29 trying to blockade the supply of oil to Cuba. So they are, but also we have a campaign against medical cooperation that Cuba offered to some countries all over around the world. Cuba is famous because our health system, our health personnel, so, and they are saying that third countries, they cannot establish cooperation with Cuba in the health sector because it's another source of incomes of Cuba. The question is, once the Cuban doctors and nurses are going back to Cuba, they are going to send U.S. doctors and nurses to attend people in the third countries? this is something that you have to ask the U.S. government.
Yeah, I also wanted to ask you, Ambassador, about the international solidarity. We reported on this Mexican humanitarian aid. Today in Moscow, Dmitry Peskov, the Russian presidential spokesman, said that Russia is evaluating options to assist Cuba. And quoting Peskov, he said, "During all these days, we've been in contact with our Cuban friends and have been discussing options to help them, possibly sending oil to Cuba." Your sense of what kind of solidarity you've been receiving around the world?
As you mentioned, we have received an overwhelming solidarity. Not only our gratitude forever and ever to Russia, to Mexico, and to the rest of the countries that have pronounced against this measure, but also, if you take a look of what is happening in the UN, you will see that we have an overwhelming support. The G77 and China, the largest group in the UN, they made a statement denouncing these new measures implemented by the U.S. government. The non-aligned movement, they also made a statement. The G77, it's 134 countries. Non-aligned movement, 124 countries. They also made a statement denouncing this situation. As we could see, the spokesperson of the Secretary General also denounced about the situation. Today in the morning, the spokesperson of the Human Rights Commissioner of the UN also denounced the measure and said that it was a violation of the human rights of the Cuban people. Yesterday, a group of independent experts of the UN Human Rights Office, they also published a press release denouncing the situation. The group of friends in defense of the Charter of the UN and the rest of the countries that you already mentioned. So everybody understand that this is a massive violation of the human rights. This is a massive violation of international law, and something have to change.
Ambassador, I want to ask you quickly about the Trump administration's attack on Cuba's medical program. For decades, Cuba has sent doctors around the world to assist in health crises, including the COVID-19 pandemic. Amidst U.S. pressure, Guatemala has announced it'll be phasing out the use of Cuban doctors, a move that's likely to disproportionately impact indigenous peoples living in poverty. Last year, Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced visa restrictions for current and former Cuban officials involved in the medical missions, as well as foreign government officials who are linked to the program. Paraguay, the Bahamas, Guyana have also ended or altered similar agreements. If you could comment quickly on that, and then overall talk about whether you feel the attack on Maduro and his abduction brought not far from here, I don't know if it's within the 25-mile zone, to the Brooklyn Detention Center, is ultimately about the United States trying to take down your country, trying to take down Cuba, led by the U.S. Secretary of State, Marco Rubio.
Okay, first of all, about the cooperation, the health cooperation, as I said, unfortunately, the Secretary of State and the government of the U.S. have started a campaign against the Cuban cooperation. And they are not thinking about those people that have been receiving the health cares from the Cuban doctors and nurses. So this is the first point. The second point is that Cuba, those are programs of cooperation that were established between Cuba and third countries because both parts decided to do it. So, and we will remain there until both parts agree that they need our service. Once someone think or decide that it doesn't need anymore, our professionals.
Seconds.
Okay. And regarding the Venezuela issue, what happened in Venezuela is a violation of international law. Forget it about Cuba, forget it about... They do something against that no one's supposed to do. You know, they attack a sovereign state, an independent state, and they kidnap a president that was elected in this country.
Are high-level talks taking place between the U.S. and Cuba and Mexico?
No. Our president said that there are no high-level talks. But he also said that we are ready to have it based on equal footing, respect on sovereignty, and respect on independence.
Ernesto Soberón Guzmán, Cuba's ambassador to the United Nations, thank you so much for joining us. We'll do an interview in Spanish and post it online. That does it for our show. February 23rd is Democracy Now!'s 30th anniversary at Riverside Church. Wynton Marsalis, Michael Stipe, Angela Davis, Naomi Klein, and many others will be there. Go to democracynow.org to get tickets. They are running out fast. Happy birthday to Brendan Allen. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Good morning. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, broadcasting at 88.3 FM and on the internet at wrct.org. Happy World Radio Day.